This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station. Community amplified.
The actions taken toward our federal employees has been evil. Absolutely evil.
Who's working, who's not, and what's being done about it here in Maryland. I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Today we talk about labor, from prison workers to federal employees, restaurant servers to university professors. Even video game programmers are mobilizing. And one programmer has struck out on her own with an electronic adventure through Baltimore.
It's a love letter from someone who has been born and raised and spent the majority of their life here.
That's coming up on WYPR's News Roundup. And good afternoon and welcome to the WYPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, News Director of the award-winning WYPR News Team. This week, we start with some truth squatting for you on cyclosporiasis and the recent bout of smoky air we saw come in from Canada. It looks like it left, but did it? And did it leave something behind? We'll talk about what that can mean for those of us working in Maryland, particularly those working outside. Because even though it's summer, typically time to take a break, one of the big stories this week has been work. Maryland's prison guards are claiming labor shortages have led to more killings in Maryland prisons, and federal workers with USAID and NIH are still reeling from DOGE layoffs last year. There's been unionizing and protesting in industries from universities to video games. Even baseball could see a lockout ahead. But before we start, we have an anniversary to mark. It's one we in public media have never had to note before, but we are duty-bound to do so. It was 1 year ago today that President Trump signed the bill that deleted federal funding for public media, something NPR, PBS, and their member stations had received since their inception more than 50 years ago. The death of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is very sad, not just for us, but also for our country, because it provided so many gifts to us. Trusted news and programming that fostered understanding in all its forms for people of all ages. CPB was also in many ways our Northern Star because of what it required of us as public media stations. You could even say it was our Constitution. So when it died, there was much sadness and mourning, which still sticks with us to this day. But there was no time to wallow in that. We still had our work to do for you. So we got up and we squared up, and we're still here today. That, in large part, is because of you, our listeners and financial supporters. We'd love to thank you a lot, but maybe even more so today. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You keep us moving every day, and it's a pleasure to serve you. As for the future, Boss once sang, "Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. But maybe everything that dies someday comes back." Live in hope, not despair. It's just a moment. This time will pass, and whatever is next, we'll go there together. One of our reporters is still here, still filing crucial stories, not just for our newsroom, but for our network and its various shows, and a reporter still winning awards, is Scott Massioni, our health reporter, who's here to talk about two stories that aren't going away. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
Cyclosporiasis is the parasite that's causing a lot of distress. It's been traced to produce. The cases are on the rise here in Maryland and nationally. So tell us what those latest numbers are.
Yeah, the CDC at this point has counted more than 41 cases in the United States, and about 110 of those are in Maryland. It's not unusual to see a couple thousand of these cases per year. However, we're really seeing these concentrated outbreaks, especially in Michigan and Ohio. And one thing to kind of point out is to confirm each case of this requires a positive stool testing for this parasite and then an interview with a state public health worker. So there may be many more cases that we're not aware of where people think they have a stomach virus and just have not, you know, gone in to get the actual confirmation that they have this type of disease.
So what's been the cause of this outbreak? Because that's been really tough to pin down this month.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the CDC and FDA have honed in on Taylor Farms. It's a multinational corporation that had some iceberg lettuce that was coming out of Mexico, which was being distributed by fast food restaurants and also grocery chains. However, that's not the only source of this disease. So it's very possible that there could be other places that this is coming from, and the federal government still hasn't completely pinned down exactly where it's coming from, which is why it's important that everyone take precautions or at least be aware of what's happening.
So what are those precautions outside of not eating lettuce or vegetables, which may not be the healthiest thing? How can people prevent this from affecting them?
Sure, yeah. So one of the important things to do is to keep an eye on the recalls that are happening. So Taylor Farms iceberg lettuce has been recalled. Make sure that you look at those dates, throw away any of those vegetables that you have from your refrigerator and make sure that you don't eat them. You might, like you said, want to stay away from some veggies for a while. However, it's just mostly leafy greens. You know, if you want some eggplant, if you want some peppers, you're probably going to be okay. But just make sure that you wash things really thoroughly. That's the most important thing. Whenever you get produce, wash thoroughly, eat things that are locally sourced if you possibly can, because it's less likely that it'll be traveling from these outside sources that could be contaminated. So go to your local farmer's market, support your local farmers if you possibly can.
Another great time to do that here in the summer. Definitely go to your local farmer's markets to check out your produce there, particularly vegetables. Now, one benefit of our show being in the afternoon is that it's away from mealtime. This is something we do have to talk about, because this parasite causes something that is more than just food poisoning or stomach flu, something I think all of us have probably had at one point. What are the symptoms of this parasite?
That's right. So, unfortunately, the most significant factor of this is explosive diarrhea. So if you're getting that, which is, you know, diarrhea that just won't stop and can be extremely dehydrating, make sure that you go and get tested and, you know, try and hydrate yourself, seek a medical professional if possible. It can be extremely dangerous for people who are young and people who are elderly. Another thing about this disease is that sometimes it takes a couple of weeks to kick in. So you may eat something and feel fine, and then a couple of weeks later, you'll start feeling these issues. Outside of the diarrhea, there's also stomach cramps, vomiting, low-grade fever, that kind of stuff. This can be, you know, pretty dangerous. It is treated through an antibiotic. So, you know, your doctor can prescribe that for you and it'll clear up within, you know, a few weeks and get you back on track.
Now, we started the show talking about how the Trump administration cut funding for public media like us. Another thing it cut is public health funding. Now, that encompasses a lot, but that also includes food inspectors. So is there any correlation between those cuts and this outbreak?
Yeah, I think that we can't necessarily, you know, draw a line specifically between these two things. However, the CDC, the FDA, and HHS have all had less people working for them, and it's making this process take longer. The results for the CDC have taken over a month sometimes to process, and so things are just moving slower, which means they have less money, fewer staff to handle these surging caseloads and to handle this sort of detective work that they need to do to look into where this is coming from and stop it and put these recall notices out.
So we're going to switch gears here to last week. If everyone can remember back to last Friday here on this show, we were talking about gas prices going up, which, spoiler alert, they did quite a bit in the last 7 days. But at that time, Baltimore and much of the Rust Belt and northeastern United States were choked with smoke from Canadian wildfires. That's kind of gone away. Usually, for the most part, it went away on Saturday. Now, it doesn't look like the dual suns of Tatooine outside anymore, but that smoke is still affecting us, and it's probably going to be for a while. You did a story about this this week for us, Scott. How and why is this still affecting us?
Yeah, so there's more than 800 wildfires that are still happening right now up in Canada and part of the northern United States. And that smoke is coming down with certain weather patterns. And that doesn't mean that just because it's not smoky outside, that smoke still isn't trailing down in lesser quantities. So it can be still dangerous, and you need to ensure that you're looking at the air quality index to see what's going on, because that can really impact your lungs. I spoke with assistant professor and environmental epidemiologist at the University of Maryland, Jennifer Stowell, about this.
So there actually can be more toxic combinations of things in smoke. Even at these lower levels of the smoke contributions, you might actually see some impacts not only to our air quality, but also to health.
So what can people do to protect themselves from this? And at the same time, a lot of people got to work outside in the summer while this is going on, while the smoke is affecting us. Maybe we can't see it, but it's still going to be affecting us. So what are some things, particularly those who have to work outside, what precautions can they take?
Yeah, if you have a respiratory illness or COPD, a chronic condition, it's important to wear a mask and check the air quality index before you go outside. You also might want to look at getting an air purifier. There's homemade air purifiers that you can make if you don't want to spend money on a lot of them, just using kind of a box fan and a filter. Keeping your air conditioning on can also be a really important factor in filtering that air and ensuring that you're breathing safely. And I also spoke with Kristen Kohler, who is a professor at Johns Hopkins, about some of the symptoms you may feel when the smoke is a lot worse.
Other people might feel chest tightness, eye irritation, and other symptoms from breathing in these particles that are really able to penetrate deep into your lungs, causing inflammation and oxidative stress.
So what precautions are local and state governments taking? We get a lot of those during the summer here because of the weather. Usually that's because of heat, which we had also last week, and also rain and flooding, which we also had in the past week. But this is smoke. So what kind of precautions and protections are local and state governments offering right now?
Yeah, there are levels of alert that you can to look for. One's called a code purple, which is when the air outside is unhealthy, and that's when you should take the precautions that we are talking about. We've also seen local governments and state governments tell some of their workers not to work outside on certain days. So it's really important just to be mindful to check your news, turn into WYPR, and find always. Out what's happening always, and find out what's happening, and make sure that you know what the air quality index is so that you can protect yourself the best.
Yeah, stay tuned to trusted news sources like WYPR and reporters like Scott who do such great work. Scott Massioni is our multi-award winning health reporter. Thank you for being on the show, Scott.
Thanks, Matt.
Coming up next, more people are being killed in Maryland prisons than other states, including our neighboring states. And the Prison Guard Union says a lack of jobs and staffing is to blame. We have a reporter with our news partner, the Baltimore Banner, to help us truth squad that question, too. I'm Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's Friday News Roundup. Stay with us after this short break.
WYPR is a proud partner with the nonprofit news site, the Baltimore Banner. Together, WIPR and The Banner are bringing local news you can trust in Maryland. Learn more at TheBanner.com.
Hey there, John Lee here. I cover all kinds of things as a reporter for WYPR, from the nitty-gritty of Baltimore County politics.
And they were threatening, saying they were going to stalk me, my wife, and where she works.
To, well, the sex lives of fireflies.
Hey, look at me. I am ready. Let's make babies.
I've been covering Baltimore County for WYPR for more than a decade, and I'm still here, and so is WYPR, even though 1 year ago, Congress voted to delete all federal funding for public media. And we'll continue to be here, bringing you fact-filled stories.
Baltimore Public Media brings a double dose of Sunday morning tunes to the Maryland State Fair September 13th. First, it's Pop Princesses with Enzlo at 11:30. Pitch perfect hits from Taylor, Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, and many more. Then at 2:30, it's a K-pop dance party from BTS to Demon Hunters with singers backed by a 10-person dance troupe. Dress your best for both September 13th. Tickets on sale now include fair admission. Details at WTMD.org.
If you want to know what's happening, you could pick up your phone and keep scrolling until you're dizzy. But to really understand, turn on Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
Beginning at 5 a.m. here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station at 88.1.
And welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup, our weekly show examining some of the big issues facing Baltimore and our region. I'm Matt Bush. This week, there was a headline from our partners at the Baltimore Banner that may have been shocking to many in Maryland. Maryland prisons rank among the nation's worst for killings. First line of that story, since 2023, more incarcerated people have been killed in Maryland prisons than in all neighboring states combined. A team of reporters worked on this story. We encourage everybody to go read it right now or after this segment's done at the very least. We have one of them joining us right now on Zoom, Justin Fenton, to tell us about what the Banner found. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on and glad you guys are still at it a year later after those cuts.
Thank you very much. Glad you guys are still at it there with us as well. From your reporting, you found last year the homicide rate in Maryland prisons was nearly four times the national average. Tell us a little bit about that number and what all you found with it.
Yeah, this is something we started to notice last year as the, you know, press releases or lack thereof from state police would come in saying that an inmate had died. It seemed like they were up. My former colleague Ben Konark did a story at the end of last year saying they were, in fact, up big. We had data going back more than a decade that showed the Maryland prison system probably saw around 2, 3, 4 inmate homicides per year. But that number jumped to 8 in 2024 and then to 14 in 2025. And then this year it was continuing. We had seen 7 through the first 5 months of the year. So we decided to take a closer look at that, at not just that issue, but also how do we compare to other states? You know, inmate populations vary wildly. So we decided to take, we tried to do a sample of as many states as we could. At first, we started out with about 20. And then our editor-in-chief said, why not 50? So we ended up gathering data from 42 states and then doing a rate. So per 1,000 inmates, how many homicides did Maryland have compared to other states? And we were second out of 42 states, only to Georgia, who have numbers that are completely off the charts. But that's a story for Georgia Public Radio. But it really put in perspective that, you know, this is, yeah, we're seeing a spike, but we're also an outlier. You know, this wasn't just this isn't just a national phenomenon, as the prison system said to us in their response. We are four times the average of those states that we surveyed.
When you started out the reporting on this, was that what you were expecting to find? I mean, how much did that, I guess, just shock you as the reporters doing this, much less once you put the numbers out there?
Yeah, I think it shocked me. I think we have like stereotypes of prisons like in the South, and, or, you know, just figured that there's got to be states that are much worse than us. But really, as the numbers kept coming in, we would get states that had zero. They would have one. I think most states that we sampled actually had zero. And as you said earlier, all the states around us. So Pennsylvania has more than twice as many inmates as us. They had had eight during that time. Virginia has 23,000 prisoners. We have 16,000. They had just three. Similarly sized states like South Carolina had 16. That's half of ours. Colorado, 9. Kentucky, 3. So it's clear that while all prisons have challenges, our challenges seem more acute.
One particular prison the story looked at and that you were going to talk about now is out in the rural western panhandle of Maryland, North Branch Correctional Institution in Cumberland. Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah, that institution has seen since the beginning of last year 8 homicides alone. That's for an inmate population that's around 1,100. The prison also in Hagerstown, Roxbury Correctional Institution, they had a case that was so egregious that we broke it out into a separate story that ran last week. In that case, there was an inmate named Colin Wolf. He was found dead in his cell, but he had been dead for hours, if not days. Decomposition was setting in. That's almost impossible. The guards are supposed to be doing checks every 30 minutes. They're supposed to do inmate head counts where they ask them to stand up and demonstrate that they're okay, like 3 times a day, and somehow decomposition was setting in. So, the broader picture here is that the unions say that this is clearly a staffing issue. They say that there are not enough staff. They're routinely what they call collapsing posts, where they say, we're just not going to staff those, as well as making people work overtime just in order to get by with the minimum number of staff. But there's cases like that one at RCI that, you know, the prison system says that's not a staffing issue. That's people not doing their jobs. And they say that they have suspended 19 people. They have banned 9 medical providers from statewide facilities and replaced the leadership, as there is a criminal misconduct investigation underway in that case. So just some really troubling things coming out of there. And as we sampled the things going on in the state, you know, we found a recent news article where, you know, there's a retired warden on the Eastern Shore who put out on Facebook this cry to have a community meeting, to have to, you know, try to call attention to these issues. That meeting will be tonight out in Somerset County. And so as you go around the state facility by facility, they're saying there's some really dire staffing issues here, and that's the first way to sort of try to chip away at this problem.
And to go on that point again, that's what the prison guard union was telling you. We also, in your story, you also had comments from civil rights attorneys and some of the prisoners themselves. But I want to stay on this point, what the union was saying about the understaffing. Nearly 1,800 correctional positions were eliminated in Maryland between 2015 and 2023. That's when Republican Larry Hogan was governor. Most of those have still been restored, but there's still a shortfall. Why is that? And are there more prisoners now for these fewer number of guards to handle?
Yeah, that was a difficult issue to try to track. I mean, it's sort of a war of words. The prison system says that they've cut the vacancy rate from about 15% to 8% in the last few years. They say that they've done a really good job job of hiring. The unions and others say that's just simply not true. They accuse them of a numbers game. I don't want to get too much into it, but they say that there's been positions eliminated, and that's how they were able to say that the rate is lower. But the prison system says that's not true. They say they've actually, again, filled to most of those positions that were cut during the Hogan administration. I think there's been some issues with closing down of some facilities, maybe, so consolidating people in some respects. But they say either way, the reality is that, you know, the staffing that they agree that they need, the staffing that they're supposed to sort of go out with, it's not being met. And the practical effects are this, because this can get tied up in labor and pay issues and things like that. But when they don't have enough staff, what that leads to is they can't let people out of their cells. They can't get them to programming. They can't get them out for even showers. The people are being locked up in many cases for like 23 hours a day, which we would recognize as a solitary confinement and discipline. So there's people being put in the cells, let out maybe for a shower, maybe for an hour and a half a day, and they're cooped up. And they're saying that that's causing tensions to rise. You throw in a problem with synthetic drugs being snuck into the system, mental health challenges, and a change in the inmate population itself, where due to sentencing reforms, maybe there's fewer people serving time for lesser sentences and more people for more serious sentences. But a counterpoint to that, too, is that a lot of the folks that we looked at, we examined the records of the victims and the suspects. They're all inmates, but I wanted to see what they were in there for. And several of the victims were in there for burglaries. One was in there for violating a probation on an indecent exposure. And this isn't like, you know, hardcore serial murderers being locked up with each other and turning on each other. It's very much more complicated than that.
Justin Fenton is a reporter with the Baltimore Banner. He's one of a team of reporters that worked on this series of stories that looked at Maryland prisons and how they are the deadliest in this region. Justin, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
And if you ever want to catch up on the News Roundup or any episodes you missed, find us wherever you get podcasts. Justin's story will be linked there in the show notes. Coming up next, we have what has happened to the federal employees who were fired under the Trump administration just over a year ago because of DOGE. How are they doing in trying to get their jobs back? We'll have more on that after this short break. This is WYPR's News Roundup, and I'm Matt Bush. Please stay with us.
Get the day I read a book.
I'm Tom Hall. On the next What Are You Reading? My guest is Krish Omara Vignaraja, the president and CEO of Global Refuge. We'll talk about a new book on immigration by Jacob Soboroff and an argument for the benefits of soft power by James Harmon. Join us for What Are You Reading? Friday during All Things Considered, brought to you by Eye Candy Optician.
One of these days I'm going to do it again.
Maryland Unfolded is a history podcast from Baltimore Public Media and WYPR. In our latest episode, we visit the Pride of Baltimore II, a reproduction of a 19th century Baltimore Clipper, and explore Maryland's maritime heritage with the ship's captains and crew. Maryland Unfolded, available the first and third Thursdays of each month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Made possible in part by Gallagher LLP.
I know how to load it into the oven and inject it with steam. And I know when to take it out when it's a perfect caramel golden brown. I know how to take the bread and load it onto a wire rack where the packers will take each loaf and they will slip it into a brown paper bag with a red stripe on the side.
Join us for more true stories told live. Next time, fun stories that make you feel good. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Every Saturday at 2 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1.
And welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, news director of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. $150 billion made its way to Maryland from the federal government in 2024, 30% of the state's GDP. That includes wages, retirement, contracts, grants. But between January 2025 and March of this year, Maryland lost close to 20,000 federal jobs. California lost only slight more, but know that they have six times the population. DOGE, or the Department of Government Efficiency, led by Elon Musk, has been blamed for most of that loss.
I got DOGE as a CDC scientist, and I realized that decisions were being made in rooms that I wasn't in and that this changed my entire life.
DOGE, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, the blunt force operation Elon Musk and President Trump used to target federal agencies.
There are 324,000 fewer federal workers now than at the start of the second Trump administration. Now, that's 10% of the federal workforce.
Just this week, Musk says he may have gotten too involved in politics and got carried away. Last week, Maryland Senator Angela Alsobrooks took complaints from those federal workers in Maryland to Russell Vogt, the Director of Office of Management and Budget in D.C.
The actions taken toward our federal employees has been evil, absolutely evil. And it is the most galling aspect of what I regard as shameful tenure at the OMB as director. It has been your outright animosity and blatant hostility toward our federal workers. And I haven't made this up. In fact, I'm going to read your own words that you famously said without remorse. You said, we want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. When they wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work because they are increasingly regarded as the villain. This is so evil. And the 150,000 federal workers who are in my state who come together, these are the patriots of our country, who've worked, many of them, for decades. They didn't care whether the president was a Democrat or Republican. They are here to serve the American people, and they will not forget how they were treated and what was said, and neither will I.
It's worth saying black women were some of the hardest hit by these cuts. Now, more than a year after DOGE, what is happening to federal workers fired by the Trump administration? We have three guests to tell us. Jeannie Briggs is joining us from Bethesda, served 24 years with USAID before being forcibly retired. Welcome to our show, Jeannie.
Thanks, Matt.
Sarah DiNatale is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the San Francisco Chronicle who has been reporting on federal workers trying to get their jobs back. Sarah, thanks you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And Raymond Limon is also joining us. Raymond served on the Merit Systems Protection Board, or MSPB, the quasi-court many former government employees have cases with to try to get their jobs back. And there have been some recent changes there as well. Thank you for coming on, Ray.
Great to be here.
Jeannie, we'll start with you. I know you were working with USAID in Congo about a week before USAID was dismantled. What did that mean for you as it was happening?
Well, you know, we had a sense that major changes were afoot because just the day after inauguration, the administration put a freeze on all foreign assistance and said they would be doing a 90-day review of everything. And so we were, you know, doing what we do, which is implementing the administration's agenda. We were going through all the activities they'd asked us to and looking at, you know, reviewing everything. And then about a week later, the situation in Kinshasa became very unstable and we had to evacuate back to Washington. And that weekend that we returned from Kinshasa, having gone through a pretty traumatic experience evacuating, was the weekend that everyone was shut off from physically going into the building of USAID and the systems were shut down. And so, you know, at that point, we were all just, I mean, everyone was sort of in a panic, but we especially, as people who had just been evacuated, really were unsure, you know, what our fate was going to be. So, you know, when Senator Alsobrooks talked about the trauma that happened, I think we were maybe triply traumatized by everything that happened.
Jeannie, we'll come back to you in a second to hear what you've been doing since that happened. But Sarah, we're coming to you. You have talked to many of these people. 140,000 people agreed to deferred resignation. Many were fired. Tens of thousands are trying to get their jobs back. So you spoke to some of them, Sarah. How is that going for them?
Yeah, so a lot of these workers feel like they're almost in a second nightmare since losing their job because their appeals to either get back pay or return to work are caught up in a bureaucratic backlog. So the mechanism that was created that was supposed to allow them to get some level of accountability, go before an administrative judge to sort of make their case that they were wrongly fired. A year after all this has happened, a year after they lost their jobs, they have very little movement on their case, if any at all. Most of them do not even have hearing dates scheduled yet. And they just feel like it is making it more difficult for them to move on. Some of them wish they could just get back pay because they're struggling to find new jobs, and others really miss going to work. A lot of the folks I talked to were people who work for the FDA.
Raymond, as we said, you served on the MSPB, appointed by President Biden. You retired early in 2025. You've been watching these cases since then. How many have there been, and how many have been successful? And why have they been successful, those who have been?
Well, by comparison, the board would typically receive 5,000 to 6,000 cases a year. And again, these are what are known as adverse actions if there's been a firing or a demotion or a long-term suspension. The board does have jurisdiction to hear these workforce reshaping actions known as reductions in force. But I could also let you know that they typically are not used. They really haven't been in place since the late 1990s when Bill Clinton was president. And so what happened in this more recent administration, they went straight to reductions in force. And so right out of the gate, they saw about 20,000 appeals coming out. As of today, there are over 6,000 of these RIF appeals sitting with our administrative judges. Now, I'm no longer on the board. I spent 27 years as a career federal employee and then the last three in this political position. But I'm very familiar with workforce reshaping efforts. And what is happening at the board is operationally, it is simply overwhelmed by the number of cases. Typically, a judge would on their docket have 20 to 30 cases. Based on these actions of this administration and kind of the, all burn all the time, they're now averaging over 155 cases. So just the sheer number of cases and the lack of resources at the board as well to meet this demand is the reason for these long delays, I believe.
Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 6-3 to uphold the law barring the president from firing a federal trade commissioner. That has changed MSPB along with many federal agencies, too. So, Sarah and Raymond, what does that mean now?
Well, I will say from an institutional standpoint, I mentioned operational. Now, from an institutional standpoint, Congress created the Merit Systems Protection Board to be an independent agency. So when these kinds of actions occur, it's on the burden of proof for the agency to bring their case and say why they did what they did. Albeit it's a pretty low bar. Agencies typically win their cases before the board, but nonetheless, the board is constructed to be independent to give that confidence that every employee or anybody who comes before the board will have their day in court and be treated fairly. Based on that decision, the current leadership at the Merit Systems Protection Board is now telling their staff and how they define themselves as they are no longer independent based on their interpretation of the Trump v. Slaughter case involving the FTC commissioner who was fired.
Sarah, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just to echo some of what Raymond said, it's also just makes it a lot more likely that if any of these judges or board members were to make a decision that the Trump administration did not agree with, because of the Supreme Court decision, it is not like far-fetched for them to believe it would be easy for them to be removed from those positions. It just, like Raymond pointed out, like really takes away the independent infrastructure that was central to why this board was created in the first place.
Jeannie, coming back to you, you've been working with a lot of the federal workers, not just at USAID where you were, but from other agencies that lost their jobs and trying to help them through this right now. But in particular, you know, at USAID, you worked with a lot of people that helped build democracy in other places. How might those skills and experiences be used right now, not just in the international sense as they were before, but here in the United States, where our democracy is a threat maybe more than it ever has been?
Yeah, so, you know, I think one of the most inspiring things about what's happened to us at USAID since last year is that we have really come together as a community. We were, you know, government employees and bureaucrats, and of course we had our connections, but, you know, once all of that goes away, a lot of people might just sort of go their own direction. The USAID folks have really held together. Some folks have run for office. Some have started organizations that are supporting a lot of the legal defense efforts. And actually, Ray and I haven't met, but I know that he's been helping with a lot of that on helping us with the MSPB cases, because the MSPB refused to certify USAID as a class. And so everyone ended up having to file individual appeals to the MSPB. And so that's taken a tremendous amount of coordination just to help people know how to do that and what their, you know, what the process is. But the community of people that I'm sort of most connected to within USAID from my work as a democracy and governance officer, a lot of us suddenly find ourselves with a lot of time on our hands. And we are people who think about these issues of, you know, democratic backsliding and what's happening, you know, we've been doing that kind of work in the countries where we were, and now we're seeing that happen in the U.S. And so a lot of people with our background have really kind of jumped into the U.S. Sort of world of democracy promotion and trying to figure out how we can connect our experience that we had in other places to what's happening now. And it's just a lot of awareness raising, training, community organizing, just trying to help people see how, you know, what's happening in our country is really not going in a good direction, and people need to realize that.
Jeannie Briggs served 24 years with USAID. Sarah DiNatale is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist with the San Francisco Chronicle. And Raymond Lamone served on the Merit Systems Protection Board, or MSPB. Thank you all for being on the show and talking about something that's kind of difficult to talk for you all. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
After a quick break, the other Maryland industries that have been hit with labor strife, from restaurants to video games. This is WIPR's News Roundup. We'll be back on the other side of this short break.
Support for WIPR comes from Chesapeake Shakespeare's Shakespeare Beyond, presenting outdoor performances of Romeo and Juliet, featuring festival-style fun and arts activities prior to the show. Open to the public, picnics welcome. Schedule and locations available at ShakespeareBeyond.com.
Practical Parenting, a podcast produced by GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches and find joy in the magical mess of summer. The sun is out and so are the schedules. But don't worry, we have your back. New episodes drop every other Friday. Tune in to get all the resources, support, and confidence you need to thrive through the chaos. Practical Parenting, available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Baltimore Public Media brings a double dose of Sunday morning tunes to the Maryland State Fair September 13th. First, it's Pop Princesses with Enzlo at 11:30. Pitch perfect hits from Taylor, Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, and many more. Then at 2:30, it's a K-pop dance party from BTS to Demon Hunters with singers backed by a 10-person dance troupe. Dress your best for both September 13th. Tickets on sale now include fair admission. Details at WTMD.org.
The Ilharmonic Orchestra blends hip-hop and classical music. The duo in charge of the group talks about building community and the challenges of bringing hip-hop into classical spaces. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And this afternoon at 4 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station at 88.1.
And welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Former government workers aren't the only employees organizing in Maryland. The first unionized Apple store in the country closed at Towson Town Center in June. The union representing more than 6,000 University of Maryland employees in the Maryland employee system held a protest yesterday after almost 100 workers were laid off.
It's unfair, it's unjust, it's despicable, it's underhanded, and I don't understand how they wake up and look at themselves in the mirror.
They're accusing the university system of illegal and unfair labor practices. And the well-loved Mount Vernon Cafe, Babies on Fire, closed after workers sent a request for the owners there to recognize their union. Another industry that unionized just 2 years ago here in Maryland, video games. Last week, the CWA workers protested outside of the headquarters of Bethesda Games in Rockville Maryland's gaming industry developed back in the 80s, recently supporting around 3,000 jobs and bringing more than $1 billion to the state. This month, those jobs started disappearing. To talk about more about these layoffs and response of the employees, we're joined by Kyle Orland, who's senior gaming editor at Ars Technica. He's here, based in Maryland. Kyle, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Just to get us started, what kinds of video games are made here in Maryland? What games might people know?
So the biggest two companies are Bethesda Game Studios, like you mentioned. They're the company behind Fallout, Elder Scrolls Online are developed in Maryland. And then in the Baltimore area, there's Firaxis, which is behind Civilization, XCOM, some other big franchises. There are some other indie developers around the state, of course, but those are the two major big budget studios, I would say.
And based on a notice sent to the Maryland Department of Labor, 379 positions were eliminated at ZeniMax Media Incorporated. They make the game Elder Scrolls Online. What departments were affected and how have people been impacted by it?
Yeah, I talked to people at this protest last week that you mentioned, and a lot of quality assurance people were let go, the people who actually test the games and make sure there's no bugs. I also talked to people who are designing storyline quests or designing the engines behind the games. They were cut back. Pretty much every department was touched at least a little bit, and a lot of the people there really worried about how the skeleton crews remaining would be able to make games of the quality that people expect from the company.
Now, after those layoffs, there were rallies, one like this that was outside of Bethesda Game Studios in Rockville, Maryland.
20 years, some of you folks! And we have made these games together. We have brought the game industry to Maryland. And it was going to be different here. They told us it would be different here, didn't they? Yeah!
These rallies were organized by ZeniMax Workers United, a union representing quality assurance testers at ZeniMax. You were at some of the rallies, you said. What were some of the talking points?
Yeah, I went to that rally in Rockville. One of the major things, while the quality assurance testers have gotten a contract last year with Microsoft, the rest of the unionized employees at ZeniMax, which is the parent company of Bethesda, they have been unionized, but they have not gotten a contract. They want Microsoft to come back to the table after negotiations kind of fell apart for that contract. And Microsoft put out a statement saying, you know, we're willing to talk, but the union says, you know, they're not coming to the table with the terms that we want. And, you know, they want protections for things like this, for laid off workers to guarantee them severance pay or to guarantee that other people could perhaps take those layoffs and protect other people who need the jobs more.
Now, a lot of people are saying the video game industry isn't sustainable, especially with more layoffs projected to come in the next year. Is that true? I can hear you're scoffing maybe a little bit at that. So is that true? And if it is, or if it isn't, you know, what needs to change anyway to get the layoffs to stop?
Yeah, it's a real tough position for the game industry, especially the bigger budget studios these days. There's so much competition now from the lower end of the industry. You can have a single person or a group of, you know, four or five people with a computer. Anyone can make a game, and increasingly they are. And you have thousands of games coming out every month on Steam. On the other end, you have these big companies spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on a game. And even if that game gets a lot of attention and sells millions of copies, that might not be enough to justify those big bloated budgets. And when you're competing with games that are so many other games that are cheaper or even free, it can really be hard to get the blockbuster sales numbers to justify those size of budgets. So because of that, we're seeing a lot of companies having to scale back from the kind of staffing that they've had in the past. It's a bad situation all around.
Kyle Orland is senior gaming editor at Ars Technica. It was great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
While there are a couple of video game industry headquarters in Maryland, there aren't many video games set here. But now you can drive across Baltimore in the Baltimore Trail, a game created by local developer Katie Dexter based on Oregon Trail, which many of us, of course, remember for our childhood. We spoke with Katie before the show.
It's a love letter from someone who has been born and raised and spent the majority of their life here. You're trying to escape down to the Eastern Shore to open water, and it's a lot harder than it should be. You might get bitten by a crab or hit a pothole that is extremely large in the middle of Baltimore Street or get stuck behind the kinetic sculpture race on your way out of town. And as you play the game, these events either boost your morale or they chip away at your health. And I think people recognize themselves in it and they recognize each other and they recognize shared experiences. And that feels really good to me.
That was Katie Dexter. You can check out her game, The Baltimore Trail, which mimics the classic Oregon Trail game, at bemoretrail.org. Next up, we'll head down to Camden Yards for an update on the Orioles as the trade deadline looms. Baseball's facing its own labor issues. What's going to happen? That's all coming up after the break. This is the WIPR News Roundup.
WIPR is a media partner for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. One subscription, seven live events at the Meyerhoff, including Pete Buttigieg, former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, and former NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. The Baltimore Speaker Series presenting The World Up Close. BaltimoreSpeakers.org, made possible in part by Cramon and Graham. You are listening to WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station at 88.1, where at 6 p.m. this evening, we will feature Marketplace. And here's today's show topic.
Consumers today want to make sure they are getting something for their money. So you know what? That regular old soda, it's just not going to cut it.
They're interested in beverages and also snack foods in general that make the most of everything that they're eating and drinking.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Ask not what you can do for a beverage. Ask what that beverage can do for you. Next time on Marketplace.
Again, Marketplace coming your way this evening at 6 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station at 88.1.
Maryland Unfolded is a history podcast from Baltimore Public Media and WYPR. In our latest episode, we visit the Pride of Baltimore II, a reproduction of a 19th century Baltimore Clipper, and explore Maryland's maritime heritage with the ship's captains and crew. Maryland Unfolded, available the first and third Thursdays of each month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Made possible in part by Gallagher LLP.
And welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, the news director of the award-winning WYPR news team. Well, the Orioles are three games below 500, and the trade deadline is coming up. This weekend, they face the Atlanta Braves at home, first pitch tonight's at 7:05, and then they're going to go on the road to face the Detroit Tigers, another team that's hanging around in the playoff chase. And then next weekend, they get the Philadelphia Phillies here, a team that's in the playoff position in the National League. So what's going on with the O's? Why are they struggling, still kind of in that middle ground, not knowing what to do? And that, how is that going to affect what they're going to do at the trade deadline? Joining us now in studio is Paul Moncano. He is the host of the Orioles podcast for our friends at the Banner. The Banner Baseball Show comes out twice a week. Paul, welcome to WYPR.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So going into the season, there were higher hopes for the Orioles. They did do some offseason moves, getting Pete Alonso and Taylor Ward, promised during spring training, even though the AL East was looked at as the toughest division in baseball, which is mostly held up. And they're three games under 500 as we approach the end of July. What's happened?
It's been a calamity of things over the past couple months. It obviously, health has been a factor, but mm-hmm. that has been a factor for just about every team. They've lost some key contributors, Blaze Alexander being the latest and probably most impactful as they near the trade deadline. But overall, the defense has really hurt them. They just have not been a solid, fundamental, and defensive team. The starting pitching has been great basically since mid-May, but the first month and a half did not go great. And then the offense has been the biggest disappointment. Mike Elias said at some point during the season that this team was built around their offense. It's the reason they signed Pete Alonso. They're hoping for a big year for Gunnar Henderson. They're hoping for a bounce-back year for Adley Rutschman. They got that, but the other guys in this lineup just haven't contributed.
So as we get down here towards the end of July, three games under 500, still in the mix for a playoff spot, but again, three games under 500 and having to fight through a lot of other people in their division. I think as Yogi Berra said, you know, it's getting late early for the Orioles. So going up to the trade deadline, which is not July 31st anymore, it's now August 2nd?
August 3rd.
August 3rd. Something for baseball fans to get used to. But anyway, so August 3rd is now the deadline. What are they going to do? Because they're in that middle ground. What are they going to do?
It's a great question. And it's definitely dependent on what happens over the next week, because they have to figure out exactly where they're going to be at the deadline. But based on the comments that Michael Elias has made, it sounds like they're going for it. It sounds like they're going to try to buy. I don't know if they'll buy rentals, you know, guys that are going to be up after this season. Their contracts are up and they're no longer under team control after 2026, because you look at the foundation of this team and they could definitely use some help beyond 2026 into 2027 as well. The fact that they're three games under 500, that obviously has an impact on this, but the fact that there are only a couple games out of that wild card spot is really what Mike Elias and this front office will be looking at. And if they have a shot, right now Fangraphs gives them about a 20-25% chance of making the playoffs, then they're going to try to go for it, because quite frankly, I don't think Elias or the front office can afford to sell two deadlines in a row.
Right, and I think that comes to is the pressure on the new ownership group already there. Obviously, when David Rubenstein took the team over, there was a lot of very positive feelings about that, because it was a Baltimore native taking it over, someone who's certainly wealthy enough. But they missed the playoffs last year. There was all that promise of those first two, those last two playoff spots, and then last year not. And then again this year, they're stuck in this holding pattern. Is the ownership feeling the pressure here? Is that one reason they might be buying at the deadline?
It's a great question. I mean, they did promote Mike Elias before last season. We didn't find out about it until several months after that. So he moved from the general manager role to president of baseball operations. So they clearly showed at that point that they had a lot of faith in him. And the owners have said before, Michael Arrighetti and David Rubenstein, the two biggest ones, that they have faith in Mike Elias to be able to get this team where it needs to go. But if they're not competitive by the end of the season, you do wonder if they will reevaluate things. It's not often that teams make changes at the top of the ladder for their front office. And Michael Elias has had this position since November 2018. He saw this team through a rebuild and got them back to the playoffs. But you do wonder if things don't go the way they expect them to at the trade deadline in the second half of the season, if they reevaluate how that ladder works.
Now, one thing that did come out this month is baseball, after the All-Star break, put out the schedule for 2027. Always a very big thing in any kind of sports league, but it seems awful optimistic to put out the schedule for 2027 right now, because baseball is facing its own labor issue, and it could be massive. So just tell us, what are the deadlines kind of on that? The owners and the players union right now are going back and forth on any number of topics, which we could fill an entire show about. But what are the kind of deadlines here to know whether we're going to see opening day 2027 in March, as is currently scheduled?
Well, the current CBA expires at the beginning of December. And the last time we saw this 3 or 4 years ago was when the owners let that deal expire and then they locked out the players. And that lasted several months. It didn't have an impact on the number of games that were played the following season. They did have to start spring training late. It was a condensed spring training, and that meant that the season started a week later, but they were able to fit in all 162 games that season. This figures to be another protracted negotiation, and I would expect, based on everything that I've heard and seen, that this would lead to another lockout. You really hope that games would not be impacted, because the last time games were impacted by something like this, by a labor negotiation, it was a major damaging thing for the sport. You hope that these two sides can see eye to eye, but given the fact that they're pretty entrenched, and obviously the biggest decision here is going to be whether a salary cap and salary floor will be implemented. The owners want both of those things. They've gone out of their way to try to get fans on their side as well. I think releasing the schedule this early in the season has something to do with it, but the players are starkly against it.
Paul Moncano hosts the Baltimore Banners Orioles podcast. The baseball show comes out twice a week. Paul, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
We here at the News Roundup are taking next week off. We'll be back with you on August 7th. I'm Matt Bush, the news director at WYPR. As always, thanks for joining us.